Deborah is going to be the next presenter. She is with the Jewish Women International, and everyone's bio is out there, so I'm not going to read everything here. Just to say that she regularly leads workshops and has led a workshop on healthy relationships for 1,000 DV advocates regularly in, in Australia. She's
global. I went to Sydney for a month and did training for
She's international.
She's really cool. What am I doing here? Great. So since we're on to pop quizzes, quick question. How many of your organizations have done? Great. You know that. SDCR. Good. So that's like the first slide. I'm going to wait to do that because what we hear, what I've been hearing from the federal government is basically that what stops small organizations, especially from really submitting their grants, is like, oh my gosh, I don't, you know, I haven't thought about this piece. And it takes a couple of weeks. So if I were to assign homework to all of you, any of you who don't have those in, you know, already there, to go back to your offices and get organized so that you can submit those grants on a timely basis and that you aren't sort of challenged by that piece of it because it's really easy. So it does is a data universal number system. It allows the federal government to track how funds are allocated. If you don't know if your organization has them already, or if you haven't applied for a grant recently, just go back to your CEO, your CFO, whoever's in charge of grants, and ask them. If you have had a grant, I'm sure you have it. You can't apply if you don't have this. And if you apply online, it takes about a day to get it. Then you have to register, central contracting registration. This is a little process. It's not that it's hard. It's that people feel like it's complicated. And this is all on the website. You're going to get a handout which will walk you through the steps easier, but I just want to take you through it a little bit. It takes about 3 days to get it. You have to have an employer identification number, which you all have because you're all paying salaries and taxes. And if you don't have one, you have to get it from the IRS, and that takes 2 weeks. And the reason it takes 2 weeks is because they snail mail you the number because it's private and they don't trust the internet. So that you can see how that was, you know, built into your timeline. If you don't have it already, it's going to take you 3 days or 2 weeks to get that EIN. And then there's another piece to it. And it has to be renewed annually. It has to be kept up to date, which is really important. So if your staff has left or the person you put down as the lead, you know, the lead person in your organization has changed, you have to be sure that you're keeping that updated information. It takes 5 days to renew it annually. So even if you applied for a grant a few years ago and you have kept up that renewal, go back and check on that. And what they ask you to do when you get when you apply for the CCR is to assign a point of contact with your organization. We always assign our ED, our executive director, because she's been there forever and she'll be there forever, unlike, you know, let's say junior staff who kind of are there between undergraduate and graduate school, they're there for a couple of years, and that's really hard to keep track of who's coming and going, but we know if she's there and if she's not, that we know to be on the lookout for that. And that person will get a special password, an MPIN it's called, and what that person does is she assigns the person who's actually authorized to submit the application on behalf of the organization. That's really important because they want to ensure that somebody isn't submitting on your behalf. It has to be the right person that's submitting. And so for that, we also assign somebody who's very senior who's there, that we know that person's going to be there. So it's like one of those people is our ED and the other person is our financial officer. So we know who is in charge. And that person is called the AOR. And what happens is that that AOR makes a password and a username. You have to wait a whole day after getting your CCR. And you complete a profile. The profile asks how long your organization has been in business. Is it incorporated? Is it a 501c3? You know, your address, phone number, easy stuff. You have to have your done in the profile. So this is the way you get it. And that username or password is the electronic signature, which is why it's so important to have, because you don't want anybody just submitting a grant on your behalf. And then the point of contact, so your ED, gets an email saying this other person has applied and authorizing that. It gets confirming that that is the right person who's authorized on behalf of the organization to submit the grant. So all this takes a while. It's not that it's hard. It's just working through the steps. So, you know, go back and do this right away so you're all good to go, and then print everything out, keep that end pin, because trust me, you're going to forget it, and, you know, when you're time to apply, you want to have a paper file on this. We have websites which walk you through this list. They have checklists and details, and this will be on your, you know, you're going to be getting this in the email from Sally. Okay, so how do you locate grants? We heard a couple of places to locate grants. I subscribe to grants.gov. and I get an email, I think it's once a day, it seems like once a day, it might be once a week, I'm not sure, it seems like a lot, and I just describe why, because you really never know where, what agency is going to be submitting, you know, putting out a proposal that could be right for you. And I think that's the easiest way to do it. The BioNet is also a great way to learn, but that's going to be a little bit more limited in terms of the grants that are available that they're posting. Okay. So then what happens is that this RFP is posted, the request for proposal is posted, and the first thing that you really want to do is submit this letter of intent. It does not bind you to submitting a proposal. It just lets them know about how many proposals are going to come in so they can start setting up their review panel. Sometimes it's peer review from the outside, and sometimes it's internally reviewed, but they have to know how many staff or how many peer reviewers they're going to need. But again, it doesn't bind you. Just saying, and it's kind of a good thing, because psychologically, like, oh my gosh, we're actually going to be doing this, and you have already weighed the pros and cons of should we be applying or not. I mean, there's a lot of cons to applying for a federal grant. It's incredibly time-consuming. I just saw a statistic that said that a good proposal, a successful proposal, takes 150 hours of staff time. Who has 150 hours of staff time?
You find it.
You find it. You have to make it happen if you're going to do it. But that's the kind of thing we have to think about before you start applying, because if you don't have that kind of staff time, you know, you want to think about it. It's also risky because you might not get it, and you're going out and talk to partners about submitting, and it can be a frustrating process. But if you start that letter of intent and you think, okay, we're going to go ahead with this, then you want to register for the conference call if you're lucky enough that the organization, that agency is providing a conference call, and it's not on every grant. But if there is one, register right away, because it's a conference call where they're going to start talking about what they're really looking for. Sometimes, I would say, often the language around the RFP is incredibly difficult to understand. I can't tell you how much staff time we put in those 150 hours. I don't even think that's included in there. Reading it, deciphering it, highlighting it, talking to other people, did you understand this way? What does this word really mean? Are they using the same word the same way throughout this? This is really hard. So you want to register for that conference call. Of course, you want to ensure right away that your organization has all that good stuff done, which you now have done. And before you, when you register for the conference call, you know, you put on your calendar. We usually have two staff people on it because it's your thing in a different way. So we find two staff people. Sit on that conference call. We have read and reread that proposal. We have written out our questions. Sometimes they'll say you can email questions in if they have them, and then they can speak to those questions. And if not, then maybe you're lucky enough to get to ask a question. But we never assume that we're going to remember our question because it's in 2 weeks. So, you know, we'll have written out our questions and be ready to go and jump on that opportunity. What you can do right away is complete the standard assurances. All these grants have what they call standard assurances. It's like your lobbying disclosure, it's that you're not going to supplant federal funds, it's all these kind of form things, and right away, and we assign a staff person that, okay, you take care of this stuff, because it's a real process, and anybody in an organization can do it. It can be somebody who's not knowledgeable about the actual draft you're submitting, just get it done, you know, print them out, and critical is get the signatures. This trips people up also. They need a signature from the EC, the EC's on travel. I don't have a signature. Now what? You know, I'm not going to be able to submit my grant because I don't have a signature. So the first thing we do is just get this process out of the way, get those signatures. And then they always ask for financial statements, which is usually an audit. You want to be sure that you know, you've spoken to your person who's in charge of that, and that you have that in your file. So we set up a separate file on our computer, on our, you know, on our network, and ask that person to get all the set assurances, get that financial statement in there, so I know that the process piece of it is good to go. That I have to think about that. Now we're talking about substance and what's the grant actually going to be about. Yeah, so that's about the conference call that you want to register for. And I should say that, and this is important, they don't always have conference calls. And if they don't, feel free and take advantage of the opportunity to call the program officer. On that RFP will be listed who the call goes in charge. Make every effort to get in touch with that person. After you've read and reread and reread this thing and you have your questions, call that person, contact that person. It can be frustrating. It can be a long process. It can be leaving messages and voicemails, but you will get a call back. So take advantage of that piece of it and make that effort to reach out to the agency to get those understandings. And importantly, what that person tells you is right. So that even if you've understood the RFP a little bit differently, take that person's word for it, because they've thought about it, and they know it isn't really that clear, but their understanding is what you need to go forward with, or else there's really no point in calling them. I also want to say something else. On the letter of intent, it happened to us that the email address to submit the letter of intent has been wrong. They posted the wrong letter of intent email address. You try to submit this thing, try to submit, and you can't get through. Pick up the phone, call them, and they'll tell you the right email address. It just happens because they're busy, that they're not always paying attention to those details. But don't let that trip you up, although it can be frustrating. Then you want to think of your realistic project. Okay, what makes a realistic project? You have to be responsive to the actual request for the grant. Okay? Even though we have these great projects that we might want to do, it might not be what they're asking for. So, and we've seen examples of this all over the place, that this is a project that I want to do. It's not going to work for this, but I'll somehow try and shift it in. Don't bother, because it's not getting any funding, and you're spending 350 hours that you don't have on something that's not going to work. So it's got to be responsive to the request. You need to have this collaborative partnership. It's not going to be one small agency coming in and getting, you know, $900,000. It's just not going to happen. So you, and the work won't be as good. You want to be able to achieve the work that you know will further the field and further your goals. You have to build this collaborative partnership. It's less, like we just heard, it's not about calling somebody the day before and saying, hey, do you want to partner? It's not like a play date. It's really having done that work in advance and having that relationship that will make it really evident that you can do that work together, that you work together, that there's a reason that you're working together, a reason that you're submitting together. And then you have to have the capacity to accomplish this incredibly wonderful project that you want to do. You have to have the expertise. Either on staff, or you're hiring consultants, but somewhere in there, or your partners are bringing it, somewhere in there, you've got to be able to show that you can do that work. You have to be able to accomplish it within the budget that you're submitting, or it's not going to go, right? And so if they're not submitting, if the budget that they're, you know, the funds that they're giving aren't enough to accomplish your thing, you're not going to get it done. Unless you can supplement it with your own funds, you're going in for other fundraising, but somehow, that budget has to be incredibly realistic, and you have to be able to do it within the time frame that you're saying. You don't want to be overly ambitious. And we've made that mistake sometimes, thinking, okay, we can do, you know, 3 times as much work as anybody else because we're so cool, and really you can't. So don't even bother going there because it doesn't help anybody. And we were told that by the project officer when I said, well, this is what we're thinking. She's like, why? Like, you're doing three times as much work as anybody else would do, cut it back. And that's really great advice of scaling back and thinking, okay, we can do, you know, be realistic about it, and we'll have a way better shot at getting this, doing the work. So critical to success is calling the grant office, collaborating with community stakeholders, and start early and don't give up. And when I say start early, I mean, you are, you know, because you've set up all this process already, right? So you are really starting from day one, and you have that internal timeline. And our internal timelines are sometimes a joke, but they at least show us how far behind we are. So we're only 10 days behind. It's good for us. So, but you really have to start right away. Don't think, oh, in 2 weeks I'll get around to this. It's just like a 10-page paper. It's like pulling an all-nighter or a column. It really isn't. It's really about starting early and assigning staff to figure out the different pieces of their grant, who's going to do what, and sticking to it. And working with that internal timeline and sort of making those adjustments as you go.
What we always give ourselves like a space deadline. Like, we have planned to submit it at least 48 hours before
Absolutely.
The actual deadline,
right.
Which we actually have been trying to meet, but it helps because also sometimes the system that you're submitting through isn't working.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to get that.
Yeah, okay.
It's going to like really be
so,
really, yeah.
Timeline matters.
Timeline is incredibly, timeline and staff responsibility so that you know who's doing what and your ad, if you're, you know, when you're partnering somebody, like figuring out who is doing what on this and having somebody sort of manage that process is really important. So what makes a good partner? Okay, how do you figure out who is a good partner? Because that's going to be critical to the success of your project. Why partner? Because it's going to leverage your resources. It's going to show that you have the capacity. It's going to further your work. It's going to make you able to do work that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So you want to have a working relationship, right? Like I said, it's something. So you want to start, you know, in this room today, I bet there are so many possible partnerships that could be happening, and maybe afterwards you'll be able to talk about that with each other, or maybe you're already working together. But really think about who are you working with, and which organizations are you not yet working with that you should be working with, or that you could be working with, you know, and call them and have a meeting in a couple, you know, next week and say, let's think about how we could work together. You want to be able to someday complement your expertise. It's not about duplicating your expertise, it's complementing it. You're leveraging those resources. You're not saying that we do this and you do that, if we do the exact same work, let's do it together. That's not going to build the field. You want somebody that's going to bring in those additional resources and that increases the likelihood of success of your project. And that's really what it's about. It's not just about getting the money, but it's about being able to do that work. If we had more time, I would help you think through, okay, some of you are good partners, but having given you these tips, you're on your own. So writing the So read that RFP again and again and again. And then call the grant office, assign staff responsibilities, create that internal timeline, and right away we can start collecting letters of support. And that doesn't mean that we're talking to the we want to already figure out the partnership, and we need that partnership letter, which is that memorandum of understanding. But it's also about letters of support, and letters of support can be really important. And that's about talking to other organizations who know your work, who know your capacity, who have done work with you, who have benefited from your work. We're going to be writing those letters of support, and that's an incredibly important piece of the grant process. It's not just about writing a proposal; it's about supporting your organization. So the basics of writing this grant are overwrite. So if they say you have 12 pages in 12-point font, double space, so you think, okay, 6-page paper, no problem. But you really want to write as extensively as you can, because you're going to cut back and edit this thing down 5 drafts later. So you want to be putting everything in there, and then you'll start editing it out. Don't think, I can only write this much, so I'm going to keep it really narrow. So write big, write broad, write more. Use bullets, because it can get really tedious for the reviewers to start reading these long sentences, and you want to lead the writer. You want to make it easy for them to understand what you're talking about. And so you use bullets, and you selectively use bold, and selectively use italics, like figure it out, so it makes it easy to read, and they don't get tripped up in it. Keep editing it, and share it with your partners. Remember, you're partnering with another organization. They need to be part of this process. Even if your staff writer says it's a great writer and grant writer is a wonderful writer, okay, everybody needs to be part of that process. You want to have meetings and conference calls and get the person there. Some people ask, should we be using a professional grant writer because we don't have capacity? There's pros and cons. A pro is obviously that somebody who's grant writing grants. The downside of, and we don't use professional, we've tried it, just doesn't work. It's too hard to explain the nuances of what you want to do. They don't have your experience. They don't understand the work you've really done. And I can't sit here and tell you what I've done. I need to be able to tell my story writing it without telling to you, because then it's like third hand and having a professional grant writer. And the other problem is that this grant writer is also writing for other organizations. Because once the word gets out, there's an affordable grant writer that everybody's done there. So you have 4 organizations submitting from the same grant writer. Well, that's going to look a little strange, and it's not going to be as strong. And you can do this, because as long as you can identify somebody who's a clear writer, you can do this yourself. You want to be sure that proposal is responsive, again, to what the ask is. Incredibly important. You want to use language from the solicitation. There was a question before about buzzwords. Okay, what they're looking for, I mean, we know the buzzwords. Okay, we're in the field, we know the buzzwords. But what they're also looking for is the language from the solicitation. So you want to copy out that language. It's like that topic sentence you did in third grade. You know how the paragraph started with a question? Remember that?
Yeah.
So you want to copy it, because it makes them feel like you are reading it and you're being responsive. So that's just like, I think that's really what they're talking about. Before you submit, obviously you want to, you know, so now you've edited and you've done it in your own font that you like to work with, et cetera, but now you want to go back and put it in Times New Roman and double check on that font size and the page length. Really important. They're not, if they say 12 pages, they're not going to read page 13. So you have to get, you know, within those margins, they're totally serious about it. They're just going to chuck the rest and you're done.
Will they even read any of it?
Yeah, they read up to that.
Okay.
So if you're 15 pages, no, you have to be able to get it in. And you can, because at the end of the day, once you edit it down, you'll be able to figure out. And then you want to give it to an outsider, somebody who doesn't, it can be somebody on your staff. Okay, so somebody who knows the field and knows what kind of work, but hasn't been part of the process, to read it and say, I understand this. It's clear to me. I didn't get tripped up on these sentences. Your bullets were really helpful. There's no typos, because, you know, you don't see those typos anymore, because you've thought about that. And that's a really important person. And so take the time to have to build that into your timeline. And somebody on your staff or an outsider, you know, whatever, or a partner, somebody from the partner organization, is going to take the time and really sit down and read this through. And then you're going to be responsive to that, and you're going to go back and do your final draft. So the narrative, this is basically what a narrative looks like. The statement of need. Why is this project needed? Right? And what are the, you know, what's the work that's really going to be done? How is this going to further the field? What are the measurable objectives that you're going to be doing? How many people are you going to be serving? What is the impact going to be? That's going to go to the evaluation piece. The program description and the plan. Okay, what's the work? What's the timeline that you're going to be doing it in? These are all usually the pieces of the narrative that you're fitting into 10 or 12 pages. What's your organizational capacity? And that goes to the work that you've done and how you're going to be able to do this work. So you have to put in some of the history of your organization and your staff expertise to show that you've done similar work, you have programs like this is where you've done it, and this is how you're going to be able to move forward. That's an incredibly important piece, especially to a new organization, an organization that hasn't had funding before, an organization that that they don't know. Never assume that they know you, no matter who you are. They might not know you. You don't really know who's reading this. So you have to make that case. Every one of these sentences is making the case. It's being incredibly persuasive. Don't assume anything about the reader. And then your staff expertise, and that's where you're getting your short bios in that are really to the point on how this person's expertise is going to work on this project. So even if that person has done, you know, three other jobs, that's not important. What's important is what that person is going to bring to this particular project. And with, you know, all this, you're putting in your partner organizations are part of it also. So you can see how short and bulleted that, you know, these pieces are because the organizational capacity is about all the organizations working together and all that staff expertise. Okay. So the four key questions that you're answering with this narrative of why do you need the funding, what will you do with the funding, and why you? What is your capacity? What are the resources that you and your partners are bringing to the project? And if you can answer these for any grant, you're in really good shape because then you'll be able to make your case. What you're doing is you're making the case to the funder that there's an urgent need, that you have a response to it that's a really good response, an effective response, that you have the capacity, and that within the budget, you're going to be able to do that work. How much money do you need? And you want to be sure that, and I just want to go back again, that needs statement connects to the actual project that they're looking, the actual implementation. When you say how much money do you need, when we say that, don't underestimate and don't overestimate. Be incredibly, you have to be realistic, and you have to be truthful about it. If you've padded, if you underestimated, you're over, or you've padded, they're going to know it. Then there's the abstract, which is one of the other pieces that you're going to put in. Don't write it at the last minute. It's not like 5 minutes before, oh my God, I've got the abstract. I'll just pull the first three paragraphs and I'm just a don't know. Assume that the abstract is the only thing they're going to read. And maybe it is. I don't know. So that abstract is a one-pager that tells your story. This is all I'm going to read. I would get it. I would know your capacity. I would know the need. I would know your capacity. I would know why it's important. I would know how you're going to do it. Okay, so that's not a last minute thing. And that's your selling tool. So it's your elevator speech. If I were in an elevator with you, what would you tell me about your project? What are those incredibly important sentences? And Okay, so your budget and your budget narrative has to be realistic, has to relate to the project. So you have to be able to go back and say, okay, I said that we're, you know, in my budget I'm putting in for training, but I forgot to talk about it in my story. And that happens. So you have to be sure that every point of your budget is spoken about in your narrative. Think of a narrative as a story. And then you're going to have what they call a budget, so that's the numbers, right? And then your budget narrative explained is the math part, you know. I'm having four trainers, you just got to be paid $450, they're making two trips, that's 450 times two, whatever it is, your 2 days of work, that's 450 times two. You're doing the math for them, showing them exactly how that money is going to be spent. Again, it has to relate back to you. If you can't find the word about training workshops in your narrative, there's no reason to put it in the budget. You're not going to get it. This doesn't compute.
I was just going to say that. I think people feel nervous when they're submitting these large grants sometimes that they're going to be stuck with those dollar amounts and that it's hard to commit to that. But with the federal grant, it's a negotiation, so once you have the award, if you have to readjust things,
yes.
it's not like something you're wed to.
Yes. You'll have those conversations with your project officer about making those adjustments. Okay, so then you have your partners, because you have thoughtfully, you know, engaged your partners in this work, and you have this project that's going to be sustainable through this partnership, and you need to submit what we call an MOU, a memorandum of understanding that you're going to be working together. Incredibly important to get started that from the beginning, because those are hard letters to write, and you have to, they have to be responsive to the project, and to talk about your organization's work, together your relationship, and how what who's going to be doing what in the project. And obviously the project won't get funded without these MOUs. If you're talking about a partnership, you've got to show that you have actually have this relationship. That's something else that you want to start at. At least let the partner know that you're going to, in the end, need an MOU and maybe help that person write it or tell what you're going to need in that. Letters of support. So what we do is we immediately think of like, who are, and again, it's not our partner, so it's who is going to help us by giving us letters of support. So we make a list and we assign out whoever has the best relationship with that organization. We are responsible for getting those letters of support. We build that into the timeline. We give like a 10-day turnaround, and we make phone calls to our to the people that we've worked with in other organizations and ask them for a letter of support. And of course, everybody we talk to is also submitting their own, you know, grants, and so we all write each other letters of support in the end. But we assign them, we assign staff and deadlines. We provide a description of the project for that letter of support, and we provide the address, because where they should have an address to, and the solicitation number. They have that, they can put that right into their letter. Okay, and we provide them with that short description of the project. We provide them an email, and then they're good to go to write it, and they send you back that letter of support, and you submit it with your grant. Then you have this time when you're going to upload your grant proposal. What happens is that it's incredibly trafficked and can be hard to get in line, right? You want to submit it early. It's due at the last one was supposed to be 8 p.m. So we started at 11 that morning, because we knew by 5 p.m. we were never even going to get in there. I mean, that internet thing was going to be just way too busy for us to be able to be sure that, confident that we're going to be able to get it in a timely way. Before you upload it, send it, you want to check for those correct signatures on all those letters that you had signed initially. Double check on that page limit. Follow the order of the documents as requested. They have a checklist, which we staple, you know, we use constantly. You have to submit your upload in that order, even though it doesn't always seem like it makes sense. That's the way they want it. That's the way they get it. You upload your documents like that. You upload early, and you post your hard copy by before the deadline, and you have also follow the order of documents the way they want it. Even though it seems a little goofy sometimes, that's the way they want it, and you obviously have printed out and saved a copy for your own files. So when you get the grant, you're good. And I think that's it.
You talk about support letters. It seems to me that fewer departments are asking for and even fewer accepting support letters as opposed to commitment letters. Do you find that there are many that are still
we still
allow
are,
you to submit?
Yes.
A lot of those electronic
they
submissions
don't,
have no
clear exactly. system. So electronic submission will only let you submit some of the documents, but in the paper file, we send all the letters of support. We absolutely send them, and they're all on letterhead and all signed by the EC of that organization. But you're right. They electronically, you can only submit exactly, and not even, I don't even think the abstract we were able to submit the last time. They don't, they're very narrow in what they want to get electronically. So the paper file is a more complete file.
I mean, it depends on the agency, but a lot of them are saying, we don't want any letters of support. So.
Then you won't. If they specifically
the other thing I've noticed, if you're talking about congressional support, they can send them directly to the agency, even though nobody else is allowed to send them directly.
Yes.
They often prefer that.
Yes. If you can get a letter of support from your time from your member, because you have that great relationship, absolutely you should ask for it and get that.
We have time for maybe one or two more questions. Anyone have a question for them?